There are very few things in our culture that get it as wrong about Christianity as how our culture thinks about the character of God. Usually I hear things like, you know, God sort of dumbed down to what a person, he or she, wants to think about God, or what they want to believe about God. Or sometimes God, you know, usually I hear kind of the grandpa analogy. You know, God's out rocking on his front porch, you know, saying boys will be boys. Or God gets dumbed down sometimes in our culture down to an it, you know, down to a force or an idea. Or God gets dumbed down to little statues that people sit in front of or pray to. That's as old as humankind, as old as Old Testament history. Even a cursory fourth grade reading of the Bible would tell somebody that not only are all of those things silly when it comes to the character of God, but that it's nothing new. People have been thinking like that all the way back through Old Testament history. So what I'd like to do over the next few weeks is just begin a series called The Character of God. And today, the topic is God's holiness, the holiness of God. What is God's holiness? You know, it's kind of one of those strange terms, and it means sort of several things together. The first is that God is separate and above His creation. God is separate from His creation, and He is above His creation. Isaiah says, "I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor devastate Ephraim again, for I am God and not man. The Holy One among you, I will not come in wrath." Now, the Bible does say that we are made in the image of God, and part of what that means is there are some similarities between we as people and God. For example, we both have personality. People and God has personality. We both have the ability to think rationally. We both have the sort of the joy of emotions. We have the share the ability to enjoy rich relationships with each other. All those things are similar to God. But there is a whole other part where we are completely dissimilar from God. For example, God is omnipresent, means He is everywhere at the same time. You know, if you saw me during my weekly schedule, you'd wonder if I'm in the right, if I can be in the right place at the right time all week. God is omniscient. He knows everything. At my age, I'm just trying to remember my name, my anniversary, my birth date. As long as humankind has been living, we are making discoveries in the world of science about things that God put together a whole long time ago. Omnipresent and omniscient. God is above His creation. He is not a creature. He is the Creator. God is separate and above His creation. Second, God is holy, pure. Pure. One of the things that I think that's so odd about us humans is that I often hear, either directly or usually sort of in undertones, kind of a kind of sitting in judgment of God, almost as if God has to prove Himself to us before we'll move towards Him, or before we'll trust Him, or before we'll worship Him. Sometimes you hear it in things like directly, overtly, like why would God allow a hurricane to come upon the Gulf Coast and upon families? Or Labor Day weekend, why would God allow something like muscular dystrophy to or muscular sclerosis, as we know in our church here, upon people? But oftentimes I hear this sort of judging of God much more subtly, almost as if, you know, I don't know why God isn't answering my prayer. But you almost get the feeling that if He doesn't answer prayer the way I want to, I'm going to take my football and go home. Or I'm not moving any closer to God until He proves to me that He is who He said He is, says He is. There's sort of that judging of God. The irony, and melancholically so, is that the opposite is true. God is holy, pure. There is not one thing, when we stand in heaven, we'll be able to look at what God has done over our lifetime and say, you know, you were wrong about that. It may seem like that to us now. Isaiah says, "Who will not fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." You know, it's almost like we're the freshman in college who goes to sit in his first class, chemistry class, and at the end of class has spent most of the time critiquing the professor. What he should realize pretty soon is it's the professor that's going to be handing out the grades. His critique of the professor doesn't really matter all that much. Number three on the inside of your handout, God abhors. He hates and rightly punishes sin. This seems like such a hard concept for our culture to get, although it shouldn't be. Habakkuk says, "Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong." You know, I hear people say, "Well, I don't believe in a God of judgment." If there's not a God of judgment, he is also not a God of love. Why is God so hard on sin? Simple, because sin is so hard on people. Simple concept. If God does not break in and punish those who are hurting other people, can we really say he's a loving God? If you had my job for a month, this would be patently clear to you. I've heard guys say, "Well, Seth, what's so wrong about internet pornography? It doesn't hurt anybody." And I say, "You've never talked to wives who have discovered their husband on the computer at 2 a.m. in the morning." It may seem innocent to you, but it is devastating to wives. They feel rejected. They feel like they're no good anymore. How can they compete to what he's looking on the screen there? They feel like there's an affair going on with an image. Sometimes I have people say, "Well, you know, we just don't love each other anymore, and adultery occurs." What's so bad about that if we don't love each other? Well, if you were in my shoes for a month, you'd know so. Talk to people who have been the innocent party in adultery situations, and you see the profound effect of sin upon their lives. All of a sudden, somebody's dealing with the word betrayal, and they never, ever in their wildest imagination would think that they would have to deal with that. Betrayal. Awful betrayal. Rejection. How long has my spouse been lying to me, playing a charade, and deceiving me? They feel like a complete fool, like they've been taken advantage of. And rejection. Now, if God is loving, he's going to do something to the adulterer. Just like if your kid keeps doing something bad, you're not going to just say boys will be boys and let him go on his merry way without some kind of forceful action that says you can go on, keep doing this if you want to, but it's going to be painful. God abhors and rightly punishes sin. Now, in Exodus 34, 6 and 7, you kind of have a mixture of how does God do this thing of loving and judging rightly at the same time. Great verses here. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. That's all the things our culture wants to think about God, and those things are all true about God. But that's not where truth ends. Yet, he does not leave the guilty unpunished. It's his holiness that comes to you and me when we are messing up and says, "You can keep doing what you're doing, but not without consequences. You're going to be fighting me on this." That's the holiness of God. Now, what does holiness look like? What I'd like to do the rest of our time this morning is take a great picture out of the book of Isaiah, where Isaiah had a picture of God's holiness. Isaiah 6, chapter 1, 6, verse 1. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple." Now, he has this picture of the Lord, and the word Lord there is the Hebrew word Adonai, which really is a title, kind of like Mr. or doctor. And it's the title for king or sovereign. I saw the king seated on a throne. Again, a picture there of a king overseeing his kingdom. High and exalted. And that's that idea of God being above his creation and above his creatures. And the train of his robe filled the temple. And here there's a picture of sort of beauty and wonder, like the bridal train at a wedding. So it's not just that here is this imposing king above us, but there's something wonderful about him at the same time. The next verse. Above him were seraphs. Now the word seraph, you can think of the word angel. Seraph in the Hebrew means the burning ones, is the literal translation. But it's an image here of angels. Each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, two they covered their feet, and two they were flying. We don't often see six-winged creatures. But there was something about being in the presence of God that struck him with these angels. Now, the question I have is, why were these angels covering their eyes and why were they covering their feet? Well, they were covering their eyes for the same reason that when your kids go out to look at the sun, especially on an eclipse, you tell them, don't look directly at the sun. Because you know that can blind them. It's a bad idea. The idea here is there's something of the just blazing, wondrous glory of God's purity in comparison to themselves that wanted to sort of hide from the luster. It was so blinding, so clean and pure. And that says there were two they covered their feet. And here the idea is sort of humility and awe. They knew they really didn't deserve to be in God's presence, but they felt privileged to do so. But there's part of them that kind of wanted to hide. And then with two, they flew, he says. And the idea is, you know, ready to do his bidding, the king's bidding, ready to go and serve him. And then the next verse. They were calling to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. In the Hebrew language, they don't have the superlative like we have in the English language. You know, we can say the holiest of the holies, the purest of the pure. They didn't have the superlative in the old Hebrew language. If they wanted to do the superlative, they just repeated the word and said it three times. The holy, holy, holy means he is the holiest. And Lord Almighty there, again, is sort of the idea of kingship. And power, but there's something drawing Isaiah and the angels to God rather than just terror. Power without purity produces terror. But power and purity together draws both Isaiah and the angels to God. And then it says the whole earth is full of his glory. The idea is the Shekinah glory of God, as the Hebrews called it. And it's the mixture of God's power and his purity, his love, combined. His glory. Romans 1:20 says, ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen in what has been made, so they're without excuse. It's kind of the same thing that we're supposed to see when we look at nature. We're supposed to look at a scene like standing down at Chrono Del Mar up on Inspiration Point and looking out over the ocean and the sand and seeing something of the wonder of what God has done. Or a beautiful sunset. Or for me, being a Colorado boy, I think about Pikes Peak. Any of you guys seen Pikes Peak before? I remember we had moved away from Denver when I was in high school, and I remember the first time going back, there were three of us that were driving. We were in grad school and driving to go on a ski trip over Christmas break. And I remember just almost with breathless anticipation driving across eastern Colorado looking for the first moment when you could see the mountains above the plains. And of course, as you're driving in from sort of southeast Colorado, the first thing you're going to see as you're driving towards Colorado Springs is Pikes Peak. Over 14,000 feet, and the top of the peak, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of feet. It's above the timberline, so no trees grow up there. You just see the granite, just the rock of the mountain and a few bushes. But it's so high that at the top of Pikes Peak, there are places where the snow is there year-round. And if you actually go up and are on Pikes Peak, hiking it, you can hear the rumble of the Rocky Mountain stream cascading its way down the mountain face. And you can smell the wondrous of the wafting up of the pine trees and aspen trees. It's just a scene of beauty. The crystal clear air that you breathe and the sky blue in the background, it's almost like it provides a stage and a backdrop for your life. There's something of wonder that's going on when I'm standing there looking at a scene like that. Well, that's what's happening here with Isaiah. Look at verse 4. At the sound of their voices, meaning the angels who were singing the Lord, it was so loud, the voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. I remember, 40 years ago going to my first rock concert, and it was so loud, I remember it was almost like the building was shaking. You know, I made the mistake of sitting up too close near the speakers, and my ears, oh, my soul, Jimmy, that took a beating. But I mean, it's like the whole thing was just, it was so loud, and it was so just charged. It was like the building itself was shaking. Well, that's something of what he's describing here. Now, if you've been in California any length of time, you've been through an earthquake. And if you've been through an earthquake, you know what that's like to sort of feel that shaking going. And, you know, they tell us to run where? To the door frames. Well, Isaiah, maybe he did that. The doorposts and thresholds shook. So even the safest place in the building was still shaking. And then it says, and the temple was filled with smoke. Now, sometimes we have this, you know, our culture likes to think of this sort of grandpa God out on the front porch. But here, Isaiah is drawing a very different picture. He's drawing also something of a picture of just the awesome power of God and His holiness at the same time. He says, the temple filled with smoke. When we were first married, we went to Streeter, Illinois, a little bitty town, 25,000 people, just for the summer, to pastor a church up there. And I was driving home across town, and I saw a two-story house on fire. And so I pulled the car over in front of the house. The front door was open, but there was no fire trucks, no police, no neighbors, nothing. It was strange. You could see fire coming out the windows up above, but nobody, I was the first person there. Jumped out of the car, ran up to the front door, yelled in. I didn't hear any voice, but there was a stairwell. So I ran over to the stairwell. And as I looked up in the stairwell to call up there, I saw something that just sent chills up my spine. There was this thick black smoke that you probably couldn't see that far through that was hurtling its way down the staircase. Apparently it had filled the whole upstairs and was now making its way downstairs, cascading down that stairwell. And as soon as it sort of made it to the ceiling of the first level, it just spread out, just began to disperse. And I watched that smoke go in every direction, the smoke behind it, pushing the smoke in front of it, all across the first floor of that house. I called upstairs, anybody up there? Anybody up there? Didn't hear a voice. When I turned to sort of, I was thinking about working my way through the first story of the house, but by that time, the 8-foot ceiling that had been clear a few seconds ago now had about a foot worth of smoke, a thick, dark charcoal smoke, and it was moving its way down. And I thought, I better stay pretty close to the front door, because if I get too far away from that door, I'm not going to be able to see where it is. And so I made a quick yell this way and a quick yell that way. Anybody here? And about the time I finished with the second one, it was down to about here, and I sort of had to bend down, and I was backing my way up towards that front door. It was terrifying. Thankfully, nobody was there, and the fire trucks pulled up about that time and began their work to put out the fire. But you sort of have two images here that Isaiah is drawing of being in the presence of God. The shaking like an earthquake and the temple filling with smoke. Hardly the image of Grandpa out on the front porch. something of the awesome power of God. Now, God's holiness reveals man's sinfulness. As he's watching this, something overtakes him. Let's go to verse 5. He says, "Woe to me," I cried. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Now, it's interesting to me that this would be his response. When Samson's parents, their mother and father, saw the angel of the Lord, they were also terrified, and they thought they were going to die. Same thing as Isaiah. And when Gideon first saw the angel of the Lord, he was so terrified by the spectacle in front of him that the angel of the Lord had to say, "Peace to you, peace be still, you're not going to die." Same response here of Isaiah as he sees God's presence. Something of the holiness, the power and purity of God. Now, why did all three of these people, four people, have the same response? It says, "Well, my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Instead of all of a sudden comparing myself to the people who were in prison and saying, "I'm a pretty good guy," they were now comparing themselves to somebody completely different. Somebody completely pure, whose purity was pictured as dazzling white light. And in that comparison, they weren't coming out so good. And what he noticed first about himself here was, "I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips." Now, I know what that's like. I remember back when I became a Christian in college, my junior year, one of the first things, well, about the third or fourth thing God began to deal with me about, was my mouth. And I had, as my mother used to say, a sailor's mouth. Some of you can relate to this. And I found these words just tumbling out of my mouth whenever something didn't go my way. I was a man of unclean lips. And I dwelt among a fraternity of unclean-lipped men. But God didn't just deal with me on cursing. I mean, there are lots of ways your lips can be unclean. It's easy to gossip about people. And it's easy not only to gossip about people, but enjoy it while I'm doing it. It's easy to be critical about people and talk about people when they're not around. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a land of unclean people. On the back of your handout, Zechariah says, "Then they repented and said, 'The Lord Almighty has done to us what our ways and practices deserve, just as he determined to do.'" Now, something happened to Isaiah where before he didn't see he had unclean lips at all. He was doing just fine. When he compared himself in God's presence, what he realized was judgment was due. And I have no excuse. It's right. It's right for God to judge who I am and to punish me for my unclean lips. That's why he was just petrified at this moment. "I am ruined," he said. He expected judgment to come. 1 Peter 1:15 says, "Just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, 'Be holy, because I am holy.'" I will tell you, in my life, we can talk about the holiness of God, and that's what we're doing today. But it isn't just a nice talk about the character of God, because God then turns around and says, "In the same way I'm holy, I expect you to be holy." Now, I will be the first one to tell you that this has been a battle in my life for 36 years since I came to Christ. It's probably one of my greatest battles. It is a daily battle. It is a very difficult thing to do. If I compare myself to prisoners or people in jail, I may be able to say I'm doing a pretty good job. But if I compare myself to the holiness of God, I've got a long, long, long way to go. I may be able to say, as using an analogy, that I can swim you know, where the average person may not be able to do two or three laps. You know, I can swim 100 laps. But if the goal is to swim from here to Hawaii, it really doesn't matter if I can do 100 laps or two laps. We've all got a long, long, long way to go. Now, thankfully, the story doesn't end here. God forgives sins when we confess sin. God forgives sin when we confess sin. Now, you remember what Isaiah had just said. I am ruined. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. We call that, the Bible calls that confession of sin, which simply means I agree with God about what he says about me. That's confession. It's just a simple statement of fact. Now notice what happens. Very next verse. Then, like immediately following that statement of confession, one of the seraphs, the angels, flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. So somebody or a group of people had come there to lay out a sacrifice before God for their sin. They were worshiping. They were looking for forgiveness for their sin. And one of the angels flew down with tongs, picked up one of the hot flaming charcoals out of that fire of somebody else's sacrifice. And notice what happened. With it, he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Now, it's pretty cool to me that as soon as he confessed his sin, God sprang into action. Not a moment to lose. And what God did was show him that instantaneously you were forgiven. And he gives him a visual. And that visual is the hot coal touching his unclean lips. My son has given me permission to tell what we call at our house coal stories. A true story from when he was in grade school. I don't remember, second or third grade maybe. But he had used the SH word at school. And we got a call from the teacher. And I talked to the teacher over the phone. And we said, yeah, we'll talk to him about that. And at first, when I talked with him about it, he was quite proud of the fact that he'd used the SH word. Felt quite grown up. But as we talked about it more, you could see that something was going on inside of him. Instead of feeling cool all of a sudden, he was starting to feel just like Isaiah. He started to be mortified that he had done that. Almost like you'd almost hear him saying, "I am a boy of unclean lips, and I study in a classroom of unclean lips." And you could tell it really bothered him. He felt unclean. Like, I don't want to be like that. And I said to him, "Well, do you want to just confess that to God and be forgiven?" And he said, "Yeah." So we both bowed our head. And he said, "You know, God, I'm so ashamed of saying the SH word." And then he paused. And I looked up, and he looked up. He had tears in his eyes. And this sudden realization, this light bulb that went off. And he said, "Dad, God just forgave me, didn't he?" I said, "Yes." The simple confession of sin was followed by the sudden forgiveness of sin. And we sat there, father and son, in kind of awe at how God did that at that moment. Now, how does this happen for Isaiah? I think it's part of the coolest part of this whole story that the sacrifice that was given to forgive Isaiah was not brought by Isaiah. Somebody else brought that sacrifice in. It's almost like God said, "Close enough, close enough." And that the forgiveness, the pardoning, is all on God's part, none of our part. All right, let's go back. Down at the bottom, your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. Wasn't because he'd done penance, wasn't because he'd given at the temple, wasn't because he'd flailed away at himself, whipped himself, or made himself feel bad for a day or a week or a month. however the severity of the offense. There's a statement from God that says, case closed. Atonement is done. And it's something that God himself took care of, not us. Sound familiar? It's like the story of the gospel. Romans 5:8. God demonstrates his own love for in this. While we were yet sinners, like Isaiah, muttering out about our unclean lips, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Story of the atonement, that God is the one that atones for us. And then lastly, God can use you to take his message to others. The story ends in just a mind-boggling way to me. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? So there's a messenger that's needed here. And Isaiah hears this. And Isaiah blurts out, here I am, Lord, send me, I'll be the messenger. Now, if you were going to ask people to send in a ministry resume, who would be a good messenger for God? Isaiah would not be on that list because remember, what we know about him was he was a man of what? Unclean lips. But God says, you're my spokesman. I'm choosing you to be my spokesman. What, me? The man of unclean lips? I remember when I first became a Christian and some guys challenged me to get involved in ministry, you know, as a volunteer. I thought, me? You've got to be kidding. I'm the worst sinner that I think God ever accepted. I mean, I'm just happy to sort of be in the party here. But I'm not one of these guys that's going to put the thing together. Are you kidding? I mean, I felt like about the least qualified person in the world. But, you know, it's like you sort of have to do time before you get involved in ministry. That's not the case. God took the least qualified guy to be his spokesman right on the spot right there. And I think if there's anything that demonstrates the amazing holiness, purity of God, and the amazing grace, it's not just that we are invited into the party to be in his family, but we are important to him. We become his spokesman. We become his ministers. We become like the angels with wings, ready to do his bidding and his serving. It's not like God saying, okay, well, all right, Seth, come on in. You know, there's room for you. You know, maybe in a couple years we'll get around to you. No. Spokesman, right now. Let's pray together. Oh, Father, I pray that you would help us to see you as Isaiah saw you that day. And just to put out of our mind all the silly, trivial pictures that our culture continually bombards us with what you are like. How our lives would be so different if we could see you as you are. Open our hearts and humble our hearts to see you and to want to know you and to seek you. You are all powerful, but you are all purity too. You are a God of judgment, not because you're mean, but because sin is so hard on people and you love us. Help us to see that holiness. And like Isaiah, help us to just acknowledge what is factual, that we have fallen far from you, that we have not only sinned, but are sinners by nature, and that we will do what's wrong. Thank you, though, that you've not given up on us, not just sent us away, but that you call us, you beckon us to come to you. And if we will just humble our hearts and just acknowledge what is true, then we can experience the wonder of forgiveness, the joy and the peace of walking with you, and the beginning of having you work in our hearts and to make us the kind of men and women that honor you as we live our lives. Father, draw us to yourself. Open our eyes.